It's nearly 3 o'clock. You're listening to K2A FM, and I'm Ann Fuller, your host. Today on Juno Afternoon, we'll talk with photographer Dave Gillott about 40 years of taking pictures in Juno. We'll learn about the annual live nativity display by Christ Lutheran Church. Brian Holst will discuss happenings with the Juno Economic Development Council. We'll get an update on activities at Eagle Crest, that Writer's Almanac, music, and more coming up. The weather, there's a winter storm warning, midnight tonight to 6 p.m. Thursday, so snow is on the way.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The two-year budget deal approved by the Senate Tuesday could partially restore federal funding hit by sequestration. As Tristan Autone reports, tribal leaders are hopeful it will enable Washington to live up to its treaty obligations.
From sequestration to the government shutdown, Indian country has been hit hard by Washington's ongoing financial infighting. Thanks to sequestration, nearly 5% of Native budgets were cut, including law enforcement, environmental protection, and tribal schools. All are considered legal trust obligations, as most tribes don't have another way to finance those services. Amber Ebarb is a budget and policy analyst with the National Congress of American Indians. She says passage of the bill will partially restore those financial reductions.
It's undoing harm that was done in the last 2 years, but it doesn't bring Indian country back to where we need to be, especially in the Indian Health Service and especially in public safety. And Indian education has much higher needs than we're able to meet with these kinds of caps, but it's still not as bad as it could be.
The budget bill is expected to move to President Obama's desk for signature by mid-January. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources has released a draft environmental impact statement on a proposed mining project. The project would take over an abandoned mine site. Supporters say development would bring jobs, but as J.P. Rehnquist with WGZS reports, tribal officials fear wild rice would be threatened by mine-related pollution.
For centuries, Native people practiced low-intensity mining and extensive trade of the Lake Superior copper and iron that is so abundant in this region that white settlers later nicknamed it the Iron Range. The Boys Fort, Grand Portage, Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and other tribal governments have long been concerned that intensive sulfide mining by Polymet could impact the health of waters and wild rice in this area for centuries. Tim Dabney, Deputy Forest Supervisor for the Superior National Forest, expects a vigorous public debate during the comment period. Dabney says input from tribes and the public, along with examining the science associated with the project, will help in the decision-making process. Nancy Schult, Water Projects Coordinator for Fond du Lac Band, has been studying the potential impact of this mine and others in the region for over a decade.
The water flows down past the reservation. It has a pollutant load that's coming off of those existing mines. And even though Polymet says that it will treat water coming off of its mine site, there's no way they can possibly capture all of the water that is running off from these mine features or that is seeping underground in the shallow groundwater and making its way into the nearby rivers and streams.
The Minnesota DNR and other contributing agencies will be accepting public comments on the proposed Polymet project until March 13, 2014. For National Native News, I'm J.P. Rehnquist.
The Bureau of Indian Education has a new permanent director. As Carrie Young reports, longtime Native educator Charles Russell has been named to the position.
The announcement was made recently during an Interior Department visit to Laguna Pueblo in New Mexico. Assistant Secretary of Indian Affairs Kevin Washburn says the appointment was a natural choice because of Russell's extensive on-the-ground experience in the field of Native American education.
He's got a really good vision for Indian education and has just a really good understanding of the problems that teachers and principals face in Indian schools and has a good manner about being able to address those.
Russell is a former school superintendent who oversaw 66 schools on the Navajo Nation. He's been serving as the agency's acting director since February of 2012. For National Native News, I'm Carrie Young.
On this day in 1971, the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was signed into law to settle land claims. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation is accepting art for the Alaska Native Art Auction, February 20th, 2014 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event to buy art. Proceeds benefit National Native News. Learn more at knba.org. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
You're listening to a Juneau Afternoon. I'm Ann Fuller, and with me in the studio is David Talat. David is leaving Juneau after 40 years as a career of photographing. He's taken pictures of thousands of kids and families all throughout the town. And now it's time to relocate south. What got you into photography, David?
It was a family hobby. Both my father and my brother were photographers, amateur, and we had a dark room in the house. So it was kind of the family hobby, but I'm the only one that ended up pursuing it professionally.
And did you, we were talking earlier, you grew up here in Juneau. Did you pursue training outside of Juneau?
Yes, I went to Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara. That's where I got my degree in photography.
Excellent. And what kinds of photos have you taken over the years?
Name something. Majority of my work has been portraiture, but I also do commercial work, scenics, you know, a little bit of everything, but mostly it was portraits.
Portraits, but given where we live here in Juneau,
right,
you can't resist the scenic shots, can you? And you've taken pictures, I imagine, of families year after year, watched the kids grow up. How does it feel to know that your work is on lots of refrigerators and hallway walls?
I think it's wonderful. And I've gone through multi-generations where they'll come in and say, you know, you did my mother's, you know, senior picture, or, you know, so I've, yeah, actually worked through more than one generation of people that have.
Right. Well, that's great. Now, technology has changed some. Are you still on the cutting edge of brand new stuff for photography?
I wouldn't say cutting edge. I keep up to date. I got dragged kicking and screaming into the digital era. I didn't think film was broken, but I wouldn't go back now. It's I think it's a great innovation.
So that switch to digital, what helped convince you to actually make that change?
A lot of it was convenience and also economic, as far as some of the volume things I did with sports and schools, that a lot of the labs were going that way and were requesting digital submissions, and, you know, I eventually got into it and kind of got into it slowly and got confidence in the quality of it. When I finally felt the quality was equal to film, then I started converting everything.
I see. And do you keep archives of photographs, and are you digitizing your older work?
Nope. All the negatives are still in boxes and, you know, still stored. I've not really made any attempt to. Now, as I'm packing and storing things, it's tempting, but it's almost more trouble than it would be worth at this point to have to go back and scan all those and convert them. But they're still.
Right.
You know, they're archival. They just take up a lot more room. So.
I see. So you still have that, the old stuff. And when we said you were relocating, that means you're leaving a house here in Juneau?
Yeah. I've rented the house out, but we'll probably put it on the market eventually. I have another house down in the Seattle area. So.
Mm. Well, that sounds like a good move. And do you feel like you're leaving Juneau or moving towards something?
Both. Both. And I'm definitely going to be back seasonally. I still have a cabin up the Taku River, and I will be coming back seasonally to do a lot of the same things I've done here. I'll be returning in the fall to do school pictures, and in the spring for sports photos, and you know, so I'll be back. I'll be back to town when there's something going, but when there isn't, well, I'll be elsewhere.
You'll be elsewhere. Well, that's good and reassuring for those of us who have known your name and seen you do these community events over and over again. What do you have a secret for what's the getting the best shot of people for a portrait?
It's different for everyone and every age, and the main thing is just keep working at it. You just never know when it's going to happen, and you just want to be able to be ready, particularly with, I think, kids. And when you get into groups, that then you have a lot of variables, so you need to shoot a lot to get the right ones.
Right, and it seems to me that's one of the things that digital cameras have made a little easier, in that you can take a lot of shots and not have to change the film. And then, but I suppose you still have to do all the analysis and judgment of what's good and then applying to grab that best shot.
Yeah. It's easier to do a volume of them, and particularly in large group shots. One of the great options with digital now, too, is... Yeah, we can do head swaps, no problem. Everybody's perfect but one. We'll take them out of the other shot, and we'll put them in that one. And it'll work just fine.
It'll work
It has other solutions, so that's good.
Okay. That's great. And so your career is, even as Juno's photographer, is not going to end, even though you're going through all this work of packing up. I was intrigued with your... story about, we asked if you'd had a garage sale and if you were going to need more than one container load to take everything south.
I'm condensing considerably what I'm taking in terms of photography equipment with me. Will be very minimal. That I mean, I probably will do some photography on that end, but not, you know, most of what I will do, my equipment will stay here and, you know, we'll use it as I need it.
All right. Well, it just sounds great to me to know that you're going off for new adventure, but we still have you here in Juneau. And do people still come and buy the family portrait?
Yeah.
I'm intrigued with that because I think it was so much an important thing to do. When you look back at older family photos, 1900s, and very formal, but it was important. And even though it was maybe awkward and people looked pretty solemn, they wanted those pictures and they shared them. And even today when we think, gosh, you can see each other on the computer, but that's not the same as having a nicely composed picture.
Yeah, you know, it's still a family heirloom, you know, for the wall.
Right, and that's a wonderful thing to be part of in your career, I should think. It's tremendous to have you here, to know that you're going off to more adventures. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Love to take a photograph, so mama don't dare.
It's 3:16 and it's Juneau afternoon. My name's Ann Fuller. We've got Jeff Brown, engineering on the board. And our guests right now are from Christ Lutheran Church to talk about the annual live nativity. Hello, Stephen Wall. You're the pastor out there?
That's correct, yep.
All right. And Vicki Bassett Olson. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, Ann.
How many years have we had such a nativity?
I believe it says 9.
9 years. It sounds like quite a project. How many people are involved in creating?
Oh, I bet there's 30 or 40.
Yeah, at least 30.
At least 30. Are there some people who've been doing it for every one of those 9 years?
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Quite a few.
And how did you get involved in it, Vicki?
We had a pastor and his wife from Wisconsin who had seen a live nativity there. And they were new here in town and wanted to add something new to the congregation. And so they started.
They started?
And I'm a willing helper.
What do you do specifically?
Well,
what does she not do?
Over the years, there's the organizational part I take care of, pretty much trying to get help for this and that. And then if it can't be done, I'll do it.
That sounds like someone very important to the success of such an event.
And every year we try to evaluate, and are there things that we can add on? And so it's really built up over these 9 years. And I think Vicki has done a wonderful job of organizing it, keeping everything straight from year to year and implementing new ideas. And it's great to have her doing that.
Well, it sounds great. Now, I haven't gone out and participated myself, so what is experience for someone coming to the live nativity?
Well, the first thing you'll notice when you approach the church, the driveway, we have Roman soldiers greeting you with flaming torches and in full armor. And then when you pull into the church parking lot, mm-hmm. Of course you have the Roman soldiers, and one of the Roman soldiers will greet you and give you a flyer about what the things that you're going to see at the live nativity. And then we also give people the opportunity, we call them census cards. You know, the Romans were taking a census, but an opportunity for you to give us some feedback, your name and information if you'd like. But then after that, you drive through, and we have the first station is a shepherd station. After that are the angel choir, and then as you drive around, you'll come to the church itself. And inside the church, we have it decorated to be like the inn in Bethlehem. And then you'll go up into the upper parking lot where we have the manger scene itself with Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus, angels standing by, and occasionally the shepherds will wander through as well. And then after that, we have the final station is the wise men. And occasionally they also will make their way over to the manger scene. And then there is room for parking. So if anybody wants to park and walk around and take their time, they're welcome to do that. And we of course, invite everybody to come into the inn inside the church and warm up. We have refreshments inside, hot cider and other things to eat as well. And if people want to just come in and relax, we have some time-appropriate music. And we're just glad to have people coming and visiting and enjoying this time of year with us.
Oh, so it's quite a welcoming event. And you say live nativity, so these Roman soldiers and shepherds and various characters, are they all members of the congregation?
Almost all of them are, yeah. Yeah.
Mm. And people drive through to see the different parts of the story. When do you start working on this, Vicki?
January, we have a critique of the last year. And then through the year, we build something or make a costume or redo something. So we usually get together again midsummer somewhere to update, and then we start again in September, October, gathering, and the first last Saturday in November or the first Saturday in December, depending. We put up the outside shelters, and it's right from there, the backdrops, props, so we're ready in 2 weeks.
I see. So there's a lot of thinking and organizing, and then when the time comes, there's still a bunch to do in the last 2 weeks, I bet.
Oh, yeah, and especially living in Juneau, you know, with the weather, you never know what you're going to get, and so we keep a close eye on that and do everything we can to try and keep it safe for people. You never know with the rain and the snow and the melting. You get a lot of ice, but we put a lot of gravel down and do what we can to keep things safe for people and, again, to invite them to be able to come and enjoy Christmas, to reflect on Jesus in the manger and what that means for us as Christians in our lives.
Okay, so it sounds like another variety of seasonal decoration compared to when I go to Fred Meyer's, and although it's red and green, the message is always about buying something.
Mm-hmm.
And here is something where, so why do you do it?
Well, I guess
it's the best gift ever.
Yeah. For us, that it's God's gift to us to send Jesus into this world for us. And as a Christian, to say that I know I am a sinner, and yet there's Jesus in the manger. He came to take away my sins. So to reflect on that message, it is the best gift. And then why do we do it? Well, because we want to give that gift to other people as well. And so it is entirely free. Just come on out and...
All right. Well, thank you. It does sound like quite the event. Can you give me exact specifics on dates and times to come see?
Yes. We had it last weekend on Saturday evening, and this coming weekend we'll do Saturday evening again from 6 till 8. So that's December 21st, 6 to 8 o'clock in the evening. And then this year we've added a Sunday late afternoon, so hopefully to accommodate some of the families, younger kids. So late afternoon on Sunday from 4 to 6 p.m., that's December 22nd.
All right, and so you know that we have friends and neighbors standing out there and in costume. So coming this weekend, well, thank you. I have learned lots of details, and I'm amazed that that's an awful lot of work.
It is, but... For us, it's worth it, yeah.
It's fun, yeah. Says Vicki, and we know that she's put in the time this year. That's the annual live nativity. It's across Glacier Highway from the DMV.
Yeah.
So go out across the river, and then you'll find it.
Yep, we're on the right, and just watch for the Roman soldier with the torch. And
I bet it's the only Roman soldier costume available this week in Juneau. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Ann.
Welcome.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 18th of December, 2013. It's the birthday of the painter Paul Klee, born near Bern, Switzerland, 1879, went off to Munich, became part of a group of expressionist artists known as De Blauwe Reiter, the Blue Rider Group. He made drawings that he described as taking a line for a walk, often featuring blocks of color behind spare figures, spidery lines, and little squiggles. Paul Klee, who said art should be like a holiday, something to give a man the opportunity to see things differently and to change his point of view. It's the birthday of Charles Wesley, born Epworth, England, 1707. His older brother was John Wesley. Charles was the hymn writer of the two founders of Methodism. He was at Oxford when he had a spiritual awakening. He and three fellow students devoted their days to Bible study and prayer, for which they were mocked by other students who called them Bible bigots or Bible moths. And then somebody nicknamed them the Methodists, and they took that name for themselves. The two Wesley brothers made a trip to the colony of Georgia. When they were young, they were aiming to make converts in this country, and it was a failure. But on the ship coming over, many of their fellow passengers were German Moravians who always sang hymns together, which was something different at the time. The Anglican Church had beautiful choirs, but there wasn't so much congregational singing. So when he went back to England, Charles Wesley began to write hymns. He wrote thousands of them, including Hark the Herald, Angels Sing, Jesus, a Lover of My Soul, Lo, He Comes with Clouds Descending. It's the birthday of Fletcher Henderson, the jazz pianist, born Cuthbert, Georgia, 1897. Best known to us as a jazz arranger, he made arrangements that emphasized the horns and left room for improvised solos between the arranged passages. It was a new sound for big band jazz. It's the birthday of another Georgian, Ty Cobb, born Narrows, Georgia, 1886. 6'1", 175 pounds, batted left-handed, threw right-handed, played most of his career for the Detroit Tigers, and when he retired from baseball, he had a lifetime batting average of .367. Here's a poem for today by Mary Oliver, entitled The Journey. One day, you finally knew what you had to do, and began, though the voices around you kept shouting their bad advice, though the whole house began to tremble, and you felt the old tug at your ankles. Mend my life, each voice cried, but you didn't stop. You knew what you had to do, though the wind pried with its stiff fingers at the very foundations, though their melancholy was terrible. It was already late enough, and a wild night, and the road full of fallen branches and stones, but little by little, as you left their voices behind, the stars began to burn through the sheets of clouds, and there was a new voice, which you slowly recognized as your own, that kept you company as you strode deeper and deeper into the world, determined to do the only thing you could do, determined to save the only life you could save. A poem by Mary Oliver, The Journey, from her collection Dreamwork, published by Grove Atlantic and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Be part of the studio audience December 20th at 5 p.m. for Forum at 360. The topic is Living the Language, featuring Tlingit speaker and clan leader David Katzig, UAS Tlingit language teacher Marsha Hotch, UAS assistant professor of Alaska Native Languages Lance Twitchell, and linguist Alice Taff. Forum at 360 will be recorded for later broadcast on 360 North Statewide TV and KTOO-FM. That's Forum at 360, Friday, December 20th, 5 p.m. at KTOO.
It's 3:31 and it's Juneau afternoon. My name's Ann Fuller. Brian Holst is here to tell us about happenings with the Juneau Economic Development Council. They put out a newsletter pretty regularly, and coming on this radio show is kind of an on-air version of it. So what's new, Brian?
Well, thanks, Ann, and good afternoon, Juneau. What's new at JDC? What's great about JDC is it is a community organization. It's run by a board of directors appointed by the CBJ Assembly, and we have a couple new board members. I just want to thank some departing board members, Jill Ramiel, Greg Fisk, and Drew Garson, who left a little earlier this summer, who served on the board for many years, and new appointed board members, Mitch Jackson, Sidney Mitchell, and Alec Mesdag. And it's an active board is probably the best term for it, which really helps us to be grounded in the community.
Thank you. And so new people stepping up to help. Now, you guys have a bunch of programs going on, and you were telling me that just this last weekend was the big robotics event at Centennial Hall. How did that go?
Yeah, it went really well, and that's one of 17 similar tournaments throughout the state of Alaska that the Juneau Economic Development Council supports through our workforce development program that we call STEM-AK. And STEM-AK is a program to build skills in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics for K-12. And the reason we focus on STEM activities is that all education is critical, of course. And we can debate long and hard about what's the most important. We're not going to go into that. But what we do know is that it is very important to have strong STEM skills. It has a direct impact on your earnings later in life, and it also helps you to solve problems. Research shows that having strong STEM skills will lead to higher wages in any profession that you go into. So that's important when we talk to employers around the state. It's really important to them that they have a talented workforce. So on this weekend, we had the Robot Jamboree. That's a seventh annual here in Juneau, and that's a celebration. It's the end. It's the final tournament of these robot teams. This particular competition are young students between the ages of probably the grades of 4 through 8, fourth grade through eighth grade typically. And then it's a Southeast Alaska tournament. So we had teams competing from Hoonah, Skagway, and Ketchikan. The Hoonah team, because of the crazy weather on Saturday, literally flew in a couple hours late and got off the plane and just started competing. And we had a record turnout at Centennial Hall. So people were able to come down and see the excitement, which is kind of counterintuitive. You think robots and you think pretty quiet, stately affair. And these are kids competing, making the robots do missions on these tables, as well as spending the morning presenting research projects and team projects that they've collaborated on. So it's a competition. There's a winner, Skagway. Team from Skagway won again, and I don't know how many times they've won in the last 7 years, but it's pretty frequent.
I see. So the powerhouse for robotics is Skagway. And when you said they had a mission on the tables?
Yeah.
So I saw one at the high school years ago where it was being able to pick up tennis balls or something. What do you remember what the mission was?
The mission, it's a various missions. And so what you have is you have this table that's set, and you have this robot that's built that includes some Legos, but it's mostly the robot itself is this autonomous vehicle that drives across the table, has these attachments, scores points by launching an airplane or recovering a person from from a storm. The theme was nature's fury, so it was all weather related. And so you score points that way, and that's the robot competition. In the higher levels at high school, and there was a high school team from Thunder Mountain that was volunteering at the robotics tournament this past weekend. At their level, the robots are much more sophisticated, and the competition's more direct. There's some contact involved. It's very, very exciting, and hopefully we'll have a chance to see. I don't know if we have any tournaments in Juneau this year, but we have teams from Juneau that will be competing statewide.
Excellent. So robotics and the teams to research and program those robots are going on. Tell me, I had to ask you what the difference was between Saturday Thing and Subelectric.
We get this a lot. And workforce development is a very important part of what we focus on for the long-term strength of the economy and thinking about the individual opportunities that represents for people. So we have opportunities for kids, young people, to engage in STEM activities on Saturday mornings, the Saturday Thing. Okay. And then we also have this new activity on Friday afternoons, which I've told staff we cannot call the Friday Thing.
No, you're going to ask them to be creative also. All right.
Exactly. And on Friday evenings it's a different theme for each month. And right now it's so electric. And so very interesting stuff with something I didn't even know existed till the program emerged was that electric conducting threads. And so you can do some very interesting thing with fabrics and toys and stuffed animals. That's a lot of fun, which is really the trick to all of this, especially for the young kids, is make them have fun and teach them something along the way. So those are programs there. In the end, they're technically free. We ask for a contribution because they're material costs, etc. The Friday night thing, brilliantly designed by staff to be at hours that would make a parent come down, leave their kid, do something fun downtown, and pick them up later. It's not babysitting, but it has the same effect on your evening.
So the Juneau Economic Development Council,
mm-hmm.
Sorry, JEDC, working for long-term benefits of developing a workforce and helping our kids discover the fun. To me, it reminds me that there was a time when using gadgets and making your own radios and building things was something that kids did mm-hmm. on their own in the neighborhood with the scout troop. And it was always a very satisfying thing to do or to watch kids actually creating things.
Right.
And you guys are working to have that happen for kids today. I think that's great.
And it's just one of many things. The workforce development is important, but we also do spend a lot of time and energy on focusing on key industries in our region.
Mm-hmm.
We call that the economic term is cluster development. And so a cluster is a set of firms in a specific industry. So think ocean products or visitor products or mm-hmm. mining service and supply or renewable energy. Those are all sectors. And so at the Juneau Economic Development Council, we, as part of our strategy for promoting growth in Juneau and the region, we very much are concerned with having a positive impact on all of Southeast Alaska, and also recognize that economies really are regional. While our primary concern is Juneau, it is in our best interest to support all of Southeast Alaska, and we do that through this industry work.
I see. And so you were talking about a culminating event for some of this work in the Innovation Summit.
Yes.
Now, that's not even this month. That's end of January?
It's January 29th and 30th. This is becoming an annual event here that the Juneau Economic Development Council brings together. We bring together with a lot of sponsorship support. The U.S. Forest Service is one of our main sponsors, and we have many corporate sponsors as well. This event is about bringing together business leaders and other leaders in government and the nonprofit world, people that are interested in our economy. And there's sort of two big things that are happening there. One is we look at these industry groups and we focus on initiatives that strengthen key industries in our region. But there's a whole other dimension to it, which is talking about and understanding better key economic concepts that affect us here in Southeast Alaska. So at this summit this year, we have really a fantastic array of speakers. We're bringing from Iceland the manager of the Oceans Cluster in Iceland. And seafood is extremely important to Southeast Alaska. And this particular experience in Iceland, they've been successful. They've been fishing for a long time. They're very good at it. And yet they've seen the need to create a cluster, meaning this sort of active approach at collaborating across industry. We're also talking about this here as well. And so we think it's really instrumental, useful for people here in our region to see how a cluster supports economic development and innovation in another part of the world. So that's one of our exciting speakers. Nationally, we were able to have this year the Economic Policy Director for the National Governors Association. And Mary Jo Waits, I just throw that name out there because she used to live in Juneau in the early 80s. So if you know her, make sure you come on out and say hi to her. She's excited to come back to Juneau. And she left Juneau and, you know, had her career, took her to Arizona, where she ran a cluster program, helped develop that for the state of Arizona, ended up at the National Governors Association, and isn't only focused on clusters, but that's something she knows well. And she's going to help us to talk about that really important question about the role of government in supporting economic development. Mm-hmm. Everyone understands that government, there's a role for government. But the debate is, what is the right role? And so I don't think she's going to come with answers, but she's going to come with examples from different parts of our nation and where the government is able to have the biggest positive impact on growing the economy. Those are a couple of the speakers that we have. We have a few other ones. It's an event that's open to everybody. Registration is open. You can go to our website at jdc.org. There's a big button on there for the Innovation Summit. Sign up.
All right. So you're encouraging people to make plans for the Innovation Summit. You've got great speakers coming. You have workshop sessions. And there's some contest for innovative new businesses. The winner is being announced, right?
That's right. Good for you. Yes. The Ha'ani and the Nature Conservancy have held a contest over the last year, 8-9 months. We've been supportive of that work as well, where they've gone out and identified, encouraged businesses to present their business ideas with a prize of winning cash support for technical assistance. Mm-hmm. They've identified 12 in the first round. These 12 came to a boot camp here in Juneau. And then now it's going to be they're presenting their business plans, and two will be selected. And those winners will be announced at the Innovation Summit on the 29th and 30th, which will be fun. We will also at the Innovation Summit be highlighting some other innovative businesses, mm-hmm. highlighting innovation in government, which is also very important to us, innovation in government that leads to economic development. And mm-hmm. in this town, there are a lot of creative people that are working in government. And we also want to be able to pull out some of those examples of really great things that are happening that supports growth in our region.
All right. So that's the plan for the end of January. And we just have a minute or two here. I wanted to ask you about some very localized projects, your downtown revitalization.
Sure. That is it's an ongoing effort that is supported with funds from the CBJ. It's important to mention that. They provide us a financial support on a yearly basis. And mm-hmm. one of the priorities they identified last year for us to focus on was downtown revitalization. That includes the Willoughby District, which we happen to be sitting in as well. And it is there's a storefront improvement program that's going to be launched. That's a specific example of in partnership with the Downtown Business Association, the International Association of Architects Southeast Branch, the Historical Society, as well as JDC, to encourage improvements to storefronts. And what the idea is that storefronts are make it a more pleasant experience downtown. And we also have some storefronts that are left vacant during next much of the year as well. And we also want to encourage people to do some fun things in their storefronts. Another exciting initiative that we have that's very local that I just wanted to throw in there if I could is about electric vehicles. And when we talk about our clusters, one of the clusters that we focus on is renewable energy. And in that renewable energy cluster, folks identify opportunities that they want to pursue. One is electric vehicles for Juneau. And that initiative, with some funding from the Juneau Community Foundation, some grant funding from outside, we've been able to, we're in the process of identifying charging stations. The notion is that to make Juneau really a center for the use of electric vehicles, our geography, our limited roads, make us ideal. Our renewable energy as well make us, you know, really ideal for electric vehicles. And so we are going to, we have the resources in place to make Juneau have the highest number of electric vehicle charging stations per capita of anywhere in the nation. And that's an initiative of this group, and there it only takes 8 of these stations to achieve that, by the way. But we want to get there first, soon, just to bring some notoriety to our positive notoriety to our community.
All right. Well, thank you for coming up with all these wonderful things that JEDC is doing in Juneau and around the region. And I think people who are intrigued with this need to really think about that end of January event, Innovation Summit, where the speakers are from Iceland. And in the meantime, kids doing STEM.
Yeah,
great to hear this stuff, Brian.
Thanks, Anne. There's a lot going on at JEDC, and so much of what we do is about collaboration and coordinating with others. So come to our website, stop by our office, get involved. There are some 30 or 40 initiatives that we help coordinate. So if you have an interest in a skill, and my guess is that we're going to help to find a place to put some of those energies to good use.
Thank you, Brian.
This is Bird Note. On the North Atlantic coast, a winter storm sends waves crashing over a rocky jetty. As the waves retreat, exposing the rocks once more, a slate-gray sandpiper clambers up. Using its long bill, it picks among the barnacles and mussels that encrust the jetty's massive boulders. At the same moment, a parallel scene unfolds on the North Pacific coast. A slate-colored sandpiper emerges from the salt spray to forage over a windswept jetty. These strange twins, two species of sandpipers, embrace a seemingly perilous life amid storm-tossed boulders instead of probing sheltered mudflats like so many of their kin. The two lookalikes are the purple sandpiper of the Atlantic and the rock sandpiper of the Pacific. They wouldn't normally be singing in winter on the jetties, but their songs are just too good to pass up. Short-legged and portly as sandpipers go, the two often feed alongside slightly larger turnstones, specialized shorebirds that share their daredevil habits. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
You're listening to Juneau Afternoon. Brian Davies, hello.
And hi.
Hi, Chris. Chris Eckel is also here in the studio. These guys are here from Eagle Crest. We're going to be talking about mountain safety. And, you know, about the main thing I know about is that there is backcountry is different than ski area boundary land. So what happens beyond the boundaries?
Beyond the boundaries is a place where you need to make good decisions on your own. We are not responsible for you out there. You're responsible for yourself. I think that is just learning some good backcountry skills, taking an avalanche course. We'll kind of come to that later. Just want to think about ski safety right now. At the beginning of the season here, you know, it's white all the way down to sea level. It looks really great, but, you know, we're still with a limited snowpack, so you need to ski with caution and really use your eyes because it's still a little lumpy and bumpy, and, you know, things are still open, and we had 22 inches of snow at the base, and we're looking at about 73 on top, so we're still not, it's good skiing, but it's still pretty skinny.
Right.
So it's early season conditions.
Early season and personal responsibility.
Yes, personal responsibility is a big thing, whether you are in bounds or out of bounds.
Okay. And so on the website for Eagle Crest, I know there's a whole section on mountain safety.
Yes.
I would imagine there are, well, I know there are boundary signs, but there are also signs and markers that tell you how difficult the trails are?
Yes. There are signs at the bottom of the lift that tell you which type of terrain that lift serves, be it, you know, green trail, blue trail, or black being the most challenging. And then we have one run at the mountain is double black. But currently, right now, we're rating the upper mountain. All the trails in the upper mountain is being double black just due to the low snow conditions. But it's skiable enough. Folks are having fun. This last weekend was an interesting start to having the upper mountain open. You know, we had 33 inches of snow fall last Wednesday or Tuesday, Wednesday.
Yeah.
And then on Saturday, of course, it was 36 on top and raining and blowing. But turned right around on Sunday, and we had a beautiful day, and people had a really good time.
That's great. I know there are skiers who were just waiting for the snow to fall and the conditions to get better. Part of the people who keep the mountain safe are the ski patrol.
Correct.
And so can you tell me, I think there's both pros and volunteers.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, the Eagle Crest ski patrols comprised of several folks that are paid. Some work 5 days a week. Some just work, you know, a few days here and there. And then we're also supplemented with the volunteer ski patrol. So it's volunteers in the community that go through, you know, pretty extensive training program and give their time to give back to skiers on the mountain. And we have a really great group of people up there.
And it's part of what makes skiing so wonderful is there are people around.
Correct, yeah. I had a student ask me a while ago for a college class what I did for a living, and I told him I was in the mental health industry. And he looked at me kind of crooked and said, "What?" I said, "The mental health industry. And if you look up there, getting out and about in winter in Juneau is a great thing, and Eagle Crest is an awesome place to do it."
That's right. And the fact that it can, your skill increases as you put the time in on it, is a good thing.
Correct. And it's last year we started this little program called Mountain Savvy, and it's a place to introduce skills so people can make good decisions. Initially it was focused at the ages, you know, 12 to 14, but this year we've kind of expanded it to 12 to 16. And I'll let Chris answer some questions about that.
Okay, so this is Mountain Savvy?
So Mountain Savvy, it's our effort to be proactive about the next generation of skiers. Basically, as you come up and you start skiing, your skills get better, but your skill base for traveling in the mountains and all those things that happen when you're out there on your own, that doesn't grow quite as fast for some of our younger kids. And so this is an effort to help bridge that gap and start to give them some ability to make decisions for themselves.
All right. So we're talking about snow conditions and why it's different depending on the amount of snow.
Yeah, and what we're doing is we're skiing them around and showing them things. So this class is really, it all takes place on snow, and it all takes place away from the groomed runs. And it's a lot of hands-on stuff because ski patrollers, sort of like kids, do much better when you can give them something to do and something to look at rather than talk in the abstract to them.
Well, this sounds like a great way of approaching the problems that can occur when people discover their strength before they discover some of the responsibilities involved. So does Mountain Savvy happen on a schedule?
So there's four Mountain Savvy classes that'll take place this year. The first one on January 3rd, the second one on January 20th, the third on February 17th, and the last one on March 21st. And each one of those classes has room and instructors set aside for up to 16 kids. And, we're hoping to see a bunch of people out there. And kids that took it last year that want to take it again, we'll pretty much do a quick review and pick up where we left off. And I'm trying to steer them towards the January 20th class.
All right. So, ideally, January 20th is the refresher extension part of this. And How do people, is there pre-registration before the day of Mountain Savvy?
Yes, if they register through the snow sports window, and you can call the snow sports window or you can show up at the snow sports window, and there's more information available online at www.skijuno.com. In this case, it's under the youth programs section. And registration is $25 to hold a space. And then the class takes place from 9:30 to 2 on the day in question. We'll meet down below, go up and get skiing right away. And kids should bring a backpack and with lunch and water for the day. And then if they have it available, they should bring safety gear. So basically an avalanche beacon, avalanche probe, avalanche shovel. If they don't have it available, we'll provide it for them, but they need to let me know ahead of time so that I can have enough sets of gear there, and then they need to have a backpack to carry it all in.
Okay, so this is definitely for people who are already thrilled to be skiers and are ready to come explore some more. And Chris Eckel, you'll be teaching all four of those classes?
Yes.
Excellent. And do those kids get to go to the avalanche probe test area?
So usually what I do is I actually set a scenario for them that's separate outside of that.
Yeah.
The Easy Searcher is a great tool, but you know, in order to give it access to the largest number of people, we've put it in a place that's not completely realistic. And so for the kids, I try to set a more realistic scenario, one that will let them practice their skills in a real way and hopefully come away with a little bit of stuff. But most of the class is geared around them not needing to rescue each other, mm-hmm. trying to make good decisions before that point happens.
Excellent. As a mom, I appreciate everybody's interest in trying. Young teens do want to learn, but we don't always set the challenge sort of high enough for them to realize that it's up to them.
And that's what we're trying to do, is give them the tools so they can make good decisions within their peer group.
Mm-hmm. And that's excellent. All right. So, yeah, I brought up this Easy Searcher terrain. It seems to me that part of what we get in the ski area is avalanche control, and we're glad you're doing it. Any last thought there?
Just be aware and ski with care. You know, it's early season, and I think just go out there with a way that you can make it last all season.
All right. That's great advice. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
This has been Juno Afternoon. We've been talking to Eagle Crest. Thursday, Joan Paradis talks with Lisa Fu about the Forum on Alaska Native Languages. We get a preview of Friday's Poetry Slam. We'll talk about an interfaith service, and Nancy DeCherney is here with Arts Up. This is K2 Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. K2 also broadcasts on these translators in the Valley and Auk Bay, K276 AF 103.1, in Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7, Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1, K220 BT serves Huna at 91.9, Excursion Inn at Nicey Strait, here K2 on K210 AS 89.9. In Juno, you can also receive K2 on GCI Cable Juno, digital channel 871, KRNN, digital channel 872, KXLL 873. We're also online at k2.org. And goodbye.
The regime air force is flying 100 sorties a day and striking rebel areas with ballistic missiles on a daily basis.
In Syria, the most intense bombardment since the war began.
For when